Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John.
And Kyle.
I'm a U.S. Marine, and the opinions expressed on the cast are my own, not official military policy.
And the opinions expressed by me are also my own, not those of my employer or any other businesses I happen to be associated with.
For today's episode, we are rejoined by special guest Colonel Brian Russell. Brian, thanks so much for coming on the cast. And since you've been on before, could you give us an abbreviated bio and some details on your new role?
Guys, it is great to be back on the cast. And part of that reason is I continue to recommend this cast to everyone who asks me what it takes to be knowledgeable on cyberspace, what it takes to be an information professional. So not only as the 2MEF Information Group Commander, which is what I was when I joined you the last time, on 30 June of this year, I fleeted up to be the operations officer for 2 Marine Expeditionary Force. So I now work directly for the 3-star commander, helping him coordinate operations across the entire MEF, which accounts for a Marine division, a Marine air wing, a Marine logistics group, and yes, my beloved MEF information group. And so, 30 June, I turned over to Colonel Koichi Takagi, I believe the first communication officer to command a MEF information group. Hint, hint, wink, wink, nod, nod, future podcast guest, perhaps. Yes. A good conversation with him. So yeah, looking forward to the conversation, guys. You guys are doing great work in this space, and I really appreciate being involved in it.
And I also just want to say that fleeted up is one of the coolest sentences that I've heard in a long time, and one of those things that can only be said by Marines. So awesome new term that I learned today.
Yes. So this conversation really came about because of an interaction the two of you had on LinkedIn. So Kyle, how did this happen, and what are we talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So Brian had made a post that called to our attention an article that was released just a few weeks ago about the Army launching a BYOD pilot program. And if I want to quote you directly, Brian, I believe you said, ahem, hashtag USMC as your share of this article title, which I thought was mightily appropriate and is something that John and I and Richard and I have talked about numerous times about the difficulty and our deep love of what BYOD represents. And so to summarize this article, which, by the way, there's a link in our show notes, and I highly recommend you read it because whoever wrote it at FedScope really didn't edit the people's use of language at all. And it reads like a bunch of surfer people talking about new technology. It's incredible. Like, they left the word likes and ums and all these things in the direct quotes. It truly tickles my heart to read articles like this because I feel like I was in the room when these excited techno nerds in the Army were talking about this. But basically, they are launching a BYOD, which is an acronym that stands for Bring Your Own Device concept, for a number of very select Army staff. And they're starting with National Guard and Reserve components and eventually planning to extend this out. And they're starting small to sort of learn how this is going to go. But this, to my knowledge, and Brian, I'm going to ask for your opinion on this too, is the first official announcement of a BYOD pilot that I've seen in the DOD. Do you agree?
I agree. First time I saw it, and probably why I got pretty excited about it, Kyle.
Yeah. So this, again, read the article, super cool, but that's a very good TLDR of just the Army is doing a BYOD pilot and they announced it. And there's some details in there about how they're planning to execute this BYOD pilot. But I think that brings us into a couple things that we need to do, some acronym definition and some topic knowledge dropping before we get into this. Because for those of you who don't know what BYOD means, bring your own device is kind of what it sounds like. It means that you can use any device that has an internet connection to authenticate into a very trusted or secure network and access network services in some way, shape, or form. And I'll give you a very specific example of this. If anyone out there has used Gmail, for example, you don't install Gmail software. You just open a website and go to it and type your username and password in. And that is a general BYOD concept, is that you can access that on your tablet, your cell phone, your smart toaster. Most of these things have the ability to access that HTTPS connection, authenticate with TLS, and get you access to some piece of software.
However, I will say it doesn't always work like that. BYOD, as the definition is not super easy to pin down, although the kind of concept of bring your own device makes sense, but it can get super wide or super narrow. A lot of people think BYOD means instead of having 2 cell phones on my pleated khakis and woven belt, I now just have the one and it's mine instead of the work issued one. But it could also mean instead of leaving your work laptop at work, you have your personal laptop, whichever one you bought, and then you bring that back and forth to work. And the experience there can be very different.
John, I completely agree with you. Sometimes this can be quite tricky. And one of the reasons is that it's based off of a technological concept that, at least in the grand scheme of things, is fairly new. And it's commonly referred to as zero trust. We've talked about this concept a couple times on this cast, but a quick refresher. Zero trust is a security concept and a technology suite that can be implemented in a variety of ways that assumes that there is no traditional network edge.
What does that mean?
So network edge is a bit of a loaded term, but the way that I always describe this to folks is, remember that firewall that used to be really important to you and your network and security team? Well, it's not really in zero trust. Every single server, port, and service, because a lot of this stuff is about containerization and serverless concepts, is its own inherent security boundary, kind of like a firewall, but also usually based on software-defined networking and web application firewalls. So when you think about the network edge, we're setting up our defensive position and we have our perimeter. And if anyone gets through our perimeter, they can basically walk around the inside of our fighting positions or our FOB or our base with no real problems. Whereas the zero trust model, and I'm doing a massive oversimplification here, assumes that there is something like a, you know, armed marine every 10 feet, or at the minimum at the entrance to every building and every porta potty and every chow hall, everything that you can think of. There's security at every step.
Excellent. And real quick, SDN and WAF.
Yes. Okay. Software-defined networking for SDN, where you have the ability to program and make software-based decisions about your network flow. It's not just I programmed the Cisco router to tell this port to talk to that port. And then WAF or WAF is Web Application Firewall. And that is just essentially a software-defined firewall that usually sits in front of a web service like an HTTPS load balancer in some way, shape, or form. But can also be gRPC and a bunch of other protocols that I don't want to define now because they're not important to this story. And for those of you out there who want to super nerd out on this, NIST has its own standard, which is 800-207 that you can go read. That is excellent at putting you to bed. And Google actually is one of the forefront companies that launched the concept around zero trust. And Google has a specific term for it that they call BeyondCorp. So you can just go to cloud.google.com/BeyondCorp, or you can go to BeyondCorp.org, which is somehow trademarked by Okta. Not sure how that works, but they also have a ton of user-friendly reading material there that will hopefully not put you to sleep too hard, that will explain the basic concepts of zero trust. And if I got to get a little nerdy on it for a quick second, there's three major elements to any zero trust environment, which is continuous verification. This is the concept of there's a security guard everywhere, and every single thing, if it provides any sort of service, is its own security boundary. And then limiting the blast radius is the second concept. And this is why it's important to have not a security perimeter, but to have security everywhere, is that let's assume that one server, I'm just keeping the example simple here, gets compromised. They can't use that as a jump off point to other servers or services on the network without having to, again, revalidate, reauthenticate, and re-go through all your security stuff with each individual hop along the way. So compromising one machine doesn't give you the keys to the kingdom. Whereas in the old way of doing things, if you compromised the firewall and got into a port on the trusted side of the network, you had free reign for most use cases that you could think of here.
Yep. Or compromised a certain account or something like that. This is essentially saying There should be no, oh my God, moment anymore.
That's right. And the last one, which I know is near and dear to John's heart, is to automate context collection and response. And basically that means you need to be monitoring all the things. You need to know what proper behavior looks like, and you need to have very fast responses to things that look like improper behavior. So those are the basic bits and pieces. We're going to have links to all these articles and all these different documents inside the show notes. There's also going to be a link to an excellent website that explains zero trust in a lot of good detail that is easy to comprehend from CrowdStrike, which is a really big name in the security space in the outside world. So we'll have all the links to that. And so I hope that I have set the context here for the technology that we are about to talk about. And with that, Brian, I'm going to kick it over to you to sort of start talking a little bit about this concept, why it was important to you, why you decided to post about it, and what your hopes and dreams are for it for the Marine Corps.
My hopes and dreams, never again to wear my 2003 Eddie Bauer cargo shorts while on Liberty. One pocket for personal phone, one pocket for government phone. And I'll tell you, it's a job requirement. I am a member of the Marine Corps' first choice as it comes to crisis response. If you think about the conversation you had last with Scott Cuomo, most of the Marine Corps is focused on the pacing threat China. They are focused in Indo-PACOM. Those are our other two MEFs, one MEF and three MEF. That's where they're focused. If the Marine Corps is called upon to solve another crisis around the world, that mission is coming to 2MEF here in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. So as the operations officer, I am in fact always on. Even on Liberty, I'm waiting for that call to come in. And I grew up in the days of having to call the duty hut before I went to a movie because I was on 96-hour recall. And I had to call when the movie was done. But now, like, every Marine is connected, right? Like, that's so easy. Just get the word out. Hey, you need to come back. You need to get to the motor pool to grab your stuff. What I find funny about the entire conversation, terms like bring your own device and zero trust, is it's almost the opposite when it comes to Marines and their own personal technology. We don't trust them. There is zero trust with Marines using their technology. When we deploy, we say, do not bring your own device because there is risk there. But I think we're missing some opportunity with that. Just like Scott Cuomo talked about, our Marines are brilliant. They're becoming more mature. They know how to use the technology. We can exploit that a little bit if we enable them with some tools and technology. So I think that's where I'd like to take the conversation is my thoughts on, bringing your own device to the fight, because that is a modern day reality in this information age of ours.
Yeah. So let's delve into that a little bit. So I think it's fairly obvious, and we don't need to talk too much about how do we get rid of the Eddie Bowers. Like, there are ways around that. And that's a pretty clear definable goal there. But what would you want on the go? So let's address this part of the problem and then move on. What do you want to be able to take from work that you're not able to today? And do we think BYOD is something that's actually going to solve that problem for the Marine Corps?
I think we can look at the Ukraine conflict and see what the true operational advantage is of bringing your own device. And I will do that using some of our very newest doctrine, Marine Corps Doctrinal Publication 8, Information. It describes how we, the Marine Corps, think about the seventh warfighting function, the others maneuver, fire, logistics, and the like. It pretty much spells out how to think about applying information to your mission or operation from the very beginning. It's no longer a bolt-on consideration after you get the plan done. It's from the very beginning. So as I look at the Ukraine conflict, like I said, they are bringing their own devices to the conflict. And there are three main elements of establishing information advantage when you look at MCDP-8. The first one is prevailing narrative. And think about the images you're seeing from Ukrainian soldiers on the battlefield demonstrating that they are defending their sovereign territory, demonstrating that they are effective at defending their sovereign territory, and getting that out pretty quickly. If you think about the spotter shooter, that sniper, and they've got a spotter concept, I think one of the most important weapons on the battlefield now is a personal device taking an image of what that strike is. And they are establishing, again, one of the three pillars of information advantage, prevailing narrative, by bringing their own device to the fight.
Yeah, and I would say you can also think of this. So not only do you have your device as a potential spotter for a shooter, you can also, if you have access, in some cases, you have access to the internet, say Twitter or other medium where this stuff actually comes out pretty quickly, you have hundreds, if not thousands, of other spotters for you. But for you to be able to utilize those spotters, you need access, ready and ubiquitous access to these things. BYOD is one way to solve that. Kyle, what are your thoughts here?
So there's a couple bits and pieces to this that I want to add that are just outside context. The use of your own device as sort of that spotter scope, as sort of that information collection point, and the speed of dissemination and the quality of dissemination is something that struck me from the early days of the conflict in Ukraine. Notably, I remember all of the videos that ended up on WikiLinks, were like people's 1.3 megapixel digital camera, and it always came out 3 weeks later when they could get to a fob that had internet or like get back home and upload these things. Whereas now everybody's got, a 12 megapixel iPhone 27. Can you tell I'm a pixel guy? And they have instant ultra high definition. I remember watching the video of a tank getting hit by an anti-tank weapon while it sat on an overpass, and you could like see the wind blowing through the trees as the explosion and the shockwave hit. And I was struck by just how high quality it was. Like, seeing battlefield footage in high quality was something I'd never really done outside of, you know, the old Mark I optics and seeing it in person. I think that there are some security considerations that we always need to understand and get through, but the tactical advantage of having ultra fast dissemination of any information cannot be understated in its value. And if you're going to try and say, oh, we're going to field every warfighter with a tactical cell phone or tactical information capture device and a tactical information upload system, I think you're missing the point here. Like, everyone's already got that thing in their pocket. Just make it have a secure endpoint to it.
Yes, but Kyle, if you paint it green and make it ruggedized and give it a minimum five-letter acronym name, more
sitting on a gold mine, John. We're sitting on a gold mine. There are dozens of dollars to be made with this concept.
I need to stop saying this on the internet.
I think dollars are still important. You know, Scott Cuomo talked a lot about force design, and one particular aspect of that is the Commandant divesting to reinvest, saving some money. The Commandant said, I'm going to pay for this myself. So right now in the Marine Corps, finding savings is huge. If we can turn in all those government devices and enable what we already have, that's a big win as well, just from a resource perspective. That's absolutely true. To the tablet point, though, let me go to the second pillar of information advantage. It's called systems overmatch. And immediately early on the conflict, I believe a lot of folks thought that the Ukrainians were absolutely overmatched by the Russian monolith. Just from a mass perspective, size of force was going to steamroll over them. And we're quickly finding out, and we know this, it's not necessarily the size of the force, it's how you use the force. And so you can find plenty of open source articles about how the Ukrainians are just taking basically open source technology to support their targeting efforts on the ground. Application development, maps on the tablet, you know, targeting software on the tablet, and they're being really effective with that. That is really what's out cycling the Russians. The ability, just like we said, now we have sensors everywhere, can sense the battlefield. Now I have a tool that can collaborate the sharing of that information. And when you match that with your fires capability, you in fact have systems overmatch. From an information system perspective, that is where they're having advantage. So they're bringing their own sensors, they're bringing their own targeting systems. That's a lot of BYOD giving them an advantage right now in this fight.
So Kyle, I want to get your opinion on two things, and these are drastically different. One, do you think the Marine Corps will actually save any money with BYOD? Or is there a way we could do that to save money, do you think? Or is that not what we'd end up doing with that?
So my opinion on this, having helped many companies adopt the concepts around Zero Trust and Beyond Corp and BYOD, is that you will save gobs and gobs of money by doing this. But it's not in the ways that you think. So when you have BYOD, you save a lot of money through speed. And that is measured in a very specific way. Let us say that you are somewhere and you have your incredibly high dollar, you know, tip top of the line laptop, and it breaks. You drop it, you spill water on it or whatever. The time it takes you to get another one of those laptops and the cost it takes you to get another one of those laptops is immense. Whereas, let's say you've already got a cell phone in your pocket. You are back in the fight immediately. Or you go to the local Best Buy or whatever the version of Best Buy is in Ukraine, and you just buy a Chromebook because it's got all the things that you need. And that Chromebook costs you $200. And it's the same Chromebook that your kid might use at school, but it now has access to all of the SaaS-based software or all of the identity-aware proxy information that you need to log in, authenticate, and get access to your resources. So that's the first part of it. The second part, though, is I want everyone who has ever had to deal with any sort of US government asset, right, your Nipper laptop, whatever, and just think of the immense time and effort that goes into the 500 different applications that you have to install to monitor and manage your security and do all these things, right? I'm thinking every sort of like Norton endpoint protection on steroids that you can think of, all that floats away. Every single bit of that floats away. You don't care about the end device anymore. You don't need the monitoring of that end device anymore. You don't need the end-to-end security on that end device anymore. And so you can save an immense amount of money on no longer needing those endpoint software systems, as well as an immense amount of money and time saved from not having to have your Marines or your civilian counterparts who are programming those things care about that anymore. Deploying those systems in the cloud and securing those cloud-based assets that you're going to have access to is a significantly simpler task to do once and repeat throughout and to troubleshoot and to do all those things than it is to troubleshoot, you know, 1,000 endpoints that are geographically dispersed all over the world and where the common denominator is often the PEBCAC, which is an acronym that stands for where the problem exists between the keyboard and the chair. You know, anyone who's ever had to like walk a very senior enlisted or officer member through like over the phone updating their antivirus signatures or installing a software patch can understand the complexity that I'm talking about here. It can be difficult to meet the needs of the average user. This sort of BYOD concept eliminates that to a great extent.
Yes, it definitely makes sense. But I will also say, if we are going to homebrew this, the stuff you were talking about, Kyle, you were talking about SDN, WAF on every single device, most likely segmenting out your portions of your application to different security boundaries. That, like, there's a lot of things that are required in there that are going to cost money. So it's not quite as simple as like, hey, a laptop costs $3,000, but if I have John bring his computer, free. There's going to be extra licenses that are going to be required, re-engineering, which is going to take time and resources and energy. And you cited BeyondCorp. Rich always talks about AWS doing something similar, right? Or Amazon doing something similar. And him saying every time, not trivial.
I agree with you, and I'm not trying to imply that this is a magic wand in any way, shape, or form, but what I am saying is that you can upskill a lot of your capability through the use of something like BYOD and BeyondCorp, where you can, with a much smaller team that is highly trained and educated and specialized and experienced, do a lot more, right? Your force multiplier with a smaller team is higher. I've seen, you know, thousands of help desk folks upskilled into being developers and programmers because their jobs weren't necessarily the same need to the company, and they could go solve more difficult, higher business value problems than they were before, right? Like responding to help desk tickets is not inherently high value to most businesses because its intent is to keep everybody working. Whereas those people now working on fundamentally new intellectual property or streamlining even more processes has much higher business value. So yes, there is cost, but I have seen in many, many, many scenarios that the cost apples to apples is significantly less. And almost all businesses don't just like submit a refund to their budget. They take that extra surplus that they now have and they reinvest it into additional security, additional development, additional business value.
And Brian, do you think this is going to be, because these are pretty complicated topics and the value proposition is not as clear and linear maybe necessarily as in some other cases. Do you think this is a difficult thing to sell? Or as a kernel, do you think it is difficult to understand? And then if you're thinking as the G3, you have to a lot of times sell your plan to the boss, the 3-star. How hard do you think this plan is to sell? How much help do you need from us to like make this sellable? Or do you think this kind of sells itself?
It almost sells itself from what I've mentioned about the operational impact, the outcomes, some of the resource efficiencies we just talked through. But I'm not so naive enough to believe this won't come with some training requirements. We absolutely want to trust our Marines, but they need to be trained to handle the technology appropriately. But again, if we go back to the Ukraine, we know this can be done. And it really relates to the third pillar of information advantage, and it's called force resiliency. So the ability to take a punch, either on our systems from a technology perspective or the cognitive perspective, kind of the will to fight, that we can take a punch and keep on fighting. That's what force resiliency means. So if we think back upwards of 8 years ago, when Russia first invaded Crimea, you might remember the stories of the Ukrainians turning on their cell phones, and bad things happen when you do that.
Taking selfies Russian in tanks where they allegedly were not.
Yeah, Russian artillery rounds come, maybe sometimes when you turn on your cell phones. But we're not seeing a lot of that now. You know, they trained themselves. They got smarter on bringing their own device to the battlefield, so to speak. And so we know it can be done. And I think you guys are probably tracking all the articles about, you know, the cyber attacks that didn't happen or the cyber war that didn't happen in Ukraine. Like, Russia brought some punch, but the Ukrainian society and military was ready for some of that punch. That's forced resiliency. So I believe the training is possible. Again, it'll have to be provided. But once we give it to our Marines, they're going to do some brilliant things with the technology.
I'll also say that taking a look at the Ukrainian situation in particular, where back in 2014, 2018, there were major cyber offensives against the Ukraine, and they, as an entire effective nation, up-leveled their cybersecurity preparedness across the board. Government, civilian, you name it. They all realized this threat is no kidding real, and we're going to take all the actions that we need to try and prevent it in the future. And I think that that is a unique example of a nationwide wake-up. And the results of that are very telling. To your point, Brian, the cyber war that didn't happen.
And Kyle, can you just, for the audience, clarify a little bit? You're not talking about the Ukrainian military, right?
I'm talking about Ukraine society star as a dot whole, star. Right? Yeah, the military, yes. The government, yes. And also every civilian, yes. And lots and lots and lots of civilian corporations, yes. And that's what I mean. You can draw a geographic boundary and say cybersecurity is better within this border, which is a crazy cool thing to say.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons that we learned is cybersecurity, .. only applied to the military ain't enough or ain't gonna cut it. And so a holistic societal response, you know, rethinking what defense looks like, necessary, I would argue.
And if you want to know more, you can listen to our podcast on the Colonial Pipeline hack from last year, and that will explain a bunch.
Okay, so the second part that I wanted to talk about, so we got the cost and the whatever. Kyle, what are your immediate thoughts on Brian's concept of essentially using BYOD for a light version of maybe C2?
I don't think that you should try to classify BYOD across narrow use cases. Now, I don't mean that as an anti the statement that Brian made. I mean it in a global macro violent level of support to that. Like, should we use it across C2? Absolutely. Should we use it across C1 through C10? Yes, I also think so. And, you know, there are going to be use cases where BYOD doesn't make sense when you're talking about, you know, different classifications of networks and things like that. But past that, I fail to see how limiting the access that your device has, as long as you can authenticate in a trusted and secure way, should ever be a thing that we attempt to implement, if that makes sense, right? Like, if there are open source pieces of software that we can have access to that can help us in the warfighting effort, yes, please, I'll take 2.
Definitely makes sense. The one thing I was at, this is very transformational thought. If you go back 10, 15 years, this conversation would be crazy, right?
So, like, I don't just disagree with you at all.
The concept of taking a cell phone on a deployment was nuts. Like,
oh, yeah.
They would generally go through our gear, have us on the flight line, dump everything out, and someone would search through your stuff and make sure you don't have a cell phone with you. Like, that level of importance. And so I want to highlight for the audience, because so much has changed so relatively quickly, that we went from something that was strictly verbatim, under no circumstances would we allow this, to yes, of course, for all of the things. And I just wanted to give us a moment to say, like, not trivial.
And I'll add a little bit more to this. I joined Google in the fall of 2018, and that was the first time that I had really been face to face with a ubiquitous global BYOD zero trust beyond court model that was in absolute full effect. Like, there are no edge cases where that wasn't the case at Google, and still to this day is. And before that, I had read about Zero Trust and BeyondCorp, and I'm in the security world, so I stay in touch with those things. But it really did feel a little bit like, oh, that's fantasy. That's only for, like, very, very specific use cases. And I don't think we could ever do that at scale across my company, you know, my company of like 150 people at the time. And so then I go join Google of 100,000 employees, and the entire organization is 100% based on this model. And they hand me this Chromebook, and they say, here you go. And I'm like, great. And they're like, here's your Titan key, and this is how you're going to log in. I'm like, awesome, sweet. And they say, have a nice day. And I could commit code to Google's repo the next day. Like that was it. That was done. And I could access anything that I wanted, and I could write any kind of code that I wanted and get it uploaded internally, get it uploaded externally. I just had to go through the approval process, and I did it all, every single bit of it from this Chromebook, right? If I wanted to deploy code, I had to connect to a virtual machine, a virtual desktop, if you will, in the cloud. They call that a cloud top. And I would do all the things from there. But most of the stuff that I interacted with on a daily basis was all just through a browser. And that's all I needed to do. And it was sort of eye-opening to see this at scale, where as long as you can culturally support it, and you've got the practices and the procedures and, you know, the policy, if you will, in place and it's approved, it's transformational. It's incredible.
And Brian, could you imagine if you could do a Marine Corps version of a money transfer for a week worth of coding and not have to wait 6 weeks for some onboarding paperwork and another couple weeks for someone to get a common access card and another couple months for them to pick up a laptop that was properly imaged? Like, could you imagine sending a transfer and then someone coding within 24 hours?
You mean being effective right when you come to work, John? Like, when I have yet to experience that in my Marine Corps career for exactly the reasons you say right there, because you have to go this process just to get access to your government device. And I won't tell you the systems I'm still waiting on. And I've been the G3 for 2 months now to have access to some of those other domains that Kyle talked about. You know, come on, it's the 21st century. We should be a little bit faster than that.
And I will say this, if I needed to spin something up in my job today, and I mean, the company that I work for in my day job is very Google centric. If I had to wait 24 seconds to access 99% of what I do, it would be a help desk ticket. And if I needed to fire up something brand new, I mean, it's 5 minutes or less and I am time on trigger.
That's a pretty big capability. So let's talk through a couple big things that we would need to make that happen: training and policy. So Kyle, help me get a civilian context on how much training do you need to do to make this happen? Is this kind of like breathing, where it just kind of happens and you don't even talk about it? Or is this something where if you don't put diligent thought and work into, it is just not going to work?
So two pieces to that. And I think that I'm going to kick it straight over to Brian when I get through this little mini rant here, because I know he's got deep opinions on this too, but I see it from two aspects, right? You need to train your technical staff quite extensively. Like, they need to embrace some new concepts, and you'll need to train your executive teams from a policymaking perspective to know what to write and how. You know, like, I wouldn't want any members of our like legislative branch of government to write zero trust policy, but I do want some very complicated people and very specialized people. I want your CISO involved, right? I want your security officers and VPs of security and VPs of networking and all those people involved in it. But I don't think that's a huge leap. In the technology space, we learn new pieces of technology all the time, and nothing that is a part of Beyond Corp is anything that is, you know, rocket surgery in any way, shape, or form. It is a good collection of standards and protocols that anybody can deploy and use. And no matter what cloud provider you're running or what data center you're in, or you could do all of this on your personal laptop, it wouldn't be that difficult for you to do. When it comes to your end users, there's very little training that you need to do. And I'll tell you why. Because if you have Marines that can figure out how to submit their expense reports from travel through DTS, right, they can figure out how to log into a username and password on a website, because their entire civilian life is already there. That's the beauty of all this that we're talking about with Zero Trust and a Beyond Corp model and all that, is everything you do in your civilian life, you don't know it, but it is all Zero Trust. All of it. Everything you do, right? You log on to social media, you're on your bank. All that is just BYOD in practice. And so you'll find that your end users will be able to adopt this incredibly quickly. But because of that, the bar is also exceptionally high on your IT teams, because they know what good looks like. And if you give them less than good, they will know it. But I also think that you're coming from the Marine Corps where, I'll be polite, less than good is probably wonderful upgrades from where you might be today. So that's my two concepts on like training side. You have the, you know, front of the house, back of the house, if you will. And that front of the house team, super easy. Like, people already know what to expect here. Back of the house, it's just, you got to put your ducks in a row, which should not be that difficult, to be super blunt. Like, I have seen companies where I was like, I don't know if they're going to be able to pull this off. And they pulled it off great. Like, it's a known at this point. There's enough success stories. You know, you can go to Stack Overflow and find the answers on most of this technical stuff at this point. It's we're ready for this.
Okay. So there's so many thoughts on this in terms of the policy. And I want to go back. I'm going to tell a cyber war story. There I am on the
yes, here we go.
US CyberCom. This is like 2016. Fresh out of cyber college, field artillery officer, you know how to spell cyber, and I'm running Cyber Command. And typically what would happen is some very highly intelligent NSA employee would come over with a report, says you got a problem right here on the DODIN, on the what? The Department of Defense Information Network. And I think I'm safe saying this at this time, but the problem that was being had was on a Navy MWR network. So morale, welfare, recreation, you know, the site you go to.
Problem on the welfare network, sir? No way.
You go there to check out the volleyball net for the weekend. You know, that's the website you go to. Like, that type of thing had been hacked or whatever. And so really, like, the lawyers came in. Is that the DODIN? Is that the Department of Defense Information Network? And, you know, the broad definition, government procured or government dollars spent on it, it's the DODIN. So I think, like, all this talk about this device of mine and my money that's segmented with some form of DODIN, who's responsible now for the defense thereof? And particularly, you know, just fill out the investigation right now, guys, right? You know, first line of the investigating officer is like who has the responsibility? I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
I think that's a really good discussion topic, if you will. I mean, my opinion on this is, if you care about the endpoint, you're doing zero trust wrong. And therefore, the responsibility of who owns that is nobody. And I know that may be an inflammatory statement, right? Like, I want the DOD to not care at all about whatever device I am logging onto to gain access to the network. What I want them to care about is that first pop, and every single service and service providing system that exists beyond that, right? Like, so think about, I guess, perimeter, you can call it that, but it's like area under the curve. It's all, it's star dot star once you hit a certain level.
And star dot star, for the non-nerds, is how we say on internet everything.
All the things.
All the thing. Every single thing, star dot star.
There's one other thought that popped in my head, and it's not necessarily, I guess it's just emblematic of what I see on my own device when I'm trying to be interactive. So we started this whole thing with LinkedIn, right? And what I find is that my life is segmented across so many applications and or devices. What I typically find doing is a great conversation on LinkedIn, and I've got to like screenshot it or share it into my government.mil email account so I can share it with my team at work. I'm like, what am I doing? Why am I not just tagging, you know, my ops chief right away? And it's seamless. So yeah, I think whoever asked if I was king for the day, like somehow to solve that just, sphere of dialogue across my social networks, like literally social networks.
I'll also add that John and I, just in the last week, easily spent 10 minutes trying to find something we sent each other. And we couldn't tell if it was over LinkedIn, over Facebook Messenger, over, you know, SMS, over Twitter, over email. And like cave people, it ended up being over email, which of course is the last place that we looked. And I agree with you 100%. I want some sort of shared context where I don't need to go on an esoteric specific network in order to tag humans. I want to be able to just be like at so-and-so's email address or whatever. Boom. It immediately notifies them.
It is 2022. And I still on a regular basis say, I'll answer you at the end of the day when I go home, because that's when I have access to my devices again.
Oh, so not just me. Good.
Oh, sir. It is not just you. No.
I don't know. That sounds kind of utopian to me, to know that I wouldn't be able to access any sort of civilian social media for many hours of the day. I'm down with that. Sign me up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is a little bit of a, like, is this a blessing or a curse? Mostly curse, but sure.
Well, I've got at least one more war story, and I think it's a mix of training and policy things, at least that we see on the training side. It was one of the very first things I did as MIG commander, and it's a pretty interesting setup. You can reference this in my Five Truths of OIE article. It's kind of the scene setter for the whole article. And essentially, one of my psychological operations teams was helping the adversary force in a force-on-force exercise. So you think Marines fighting each other here at Camp Lejeune. My PsyOps team was helping the bad guys, so to speak, fight the good guys. And they had captured a Marine as part of the exercise. And they took a couple pictures of him and texted those pictures to the exercise force commander on his government cell phone to say, hey, we have Lance Corporal Knucklehead here captured. Well, my Comstrat and PsyOps Marines went to social media and found Lance Corporal Knucklehead's real social media pages, Facebook and all that. And they took some screenshots. And then the graphic artist went to town and made some comments like the exercise, whatever name was, hey, exercise sucks. And my commander, so-and-so, you know, Lieutenant Colonel Smith sucks. And then texted that to Lieutenant Colonel Smith on his government cell phone. And so in violation of 2nd Marine Division cell phone policy, right? Don't bring your own device. You're not supposed to have your cell phone in the field. And so what is Lieutenant Colonel Smith inclined to believe? Lance Corporals don't obey the rules and they bring their cell phones to the field. So he immediately thinks, you know, I've got a Lance Corporal that's not obeying the rules. He's criticizing me. Like the Marine was almost brought up on charges.
Cue the NJP.
Until exercise control said, time out. It's all fake. It was all fake news. But I mentioned that because it took us about 2 months for me to get the authority to text the government cell phone from a personal device through local cellular networks here at Camp Lejeune. And I just mentioned that as something we have to do as a service to build the robust training environments from the technical perspective, but also the cognitive, right? It's all reflexive control. Just like you said in the last episode, Kyle, you don't click on anything. Yeah, you know, you got to be careful. You're conditioned to behave a certain way with your technology, and we can use that to our advantage, but we need to put our Marines in that environment to understand and get that wake-up call. Just like I said, Ukraine got a wake-up call. We need to give our Marines that wake-up call of what's out there.
I was actually going to say, when you were talking earlier about sensors and shooters and all that stuff, I also immediately went to disinformation. And I know the things we're learning from Ukraine, there was a lot of silly stuff. It's difficult to even kind of recall all of it, but, you know, like the Ukrainians being Nazis and the Russians didn't bomb this place. It was actually the Ukrainians who bombed themselves to make them look bad. And you got to think, to Kyle's point of like the 16 megapixel sensor in every single pocket, having pictures of those things and being able to very clearly and very easily refute so many of these things so quickly, or as is the case of the beginning of Ukraine, pre-refuting, using intelligence to kind of say, hey, we see people headed in this direction. If anybody says that there's not an invasion, here is clear and present proof that it is not. I guess what I'm trying to say is, as a counter disinformation, that could also be a powerful tool. But to your point, it is one critique of a lieutenant colonel away from going completely sideways.
So, Brian, I want to bring this back to where I hope we want to see this, which is you've got some strong opinions about how we can implement this in the military, in the Marine Corps, and what problems we're going to experience. And so I want to like pick your brain. Like, what do you see in the day to day? Where do you think our roadblocks are going to be? You know, where do we need to uplift in a little bit? And, you know, we talked about war stories and all that, but let's put the rubber to the road about, I'm going to make you king for the day, right? You're commandant for the day. You are controlling all the legislative everything for the day. Like, what do you want to do here?
I'll give you one key example, really on the mind of our commandant, really on the mind of my current commanding general, and that's retention. And that's what Scott Cuomo talked about. It's not about just bringing them in and kicking them out. You know, we're a very young force, and we used to be very proud of that. It's a more mature Marine. We need to retain that Marine, him or her, for the long term. Well, where do you think they go to find the next thing, the next job, the next of, you know, they're on their phone. And in the civilian world, that information is very easy to find. We talked about LinkedIn, didn't we, Kyle? Like when we started here. Yep. And that's just so, but what does it take to retain a Marine? I got to walk to the career planner. I got to listen to the career planner, give a spiel. I've got to sign some paperwork that has to go through my chain of command. That has to go to headquarters of Marine Corps. We're convening panels for our senior Marines right now. It takes some time. You know, that would be the one king for the day, is what does that look like on the Marine's device? you know, just that interactive search for the job, the next opportunity in the Marine Corps, have a dialogue with that boss, if you will, across there at Camp Pendleton. That's where we need to be meeting our Marines. And for me, engaging the Marines with our information is the best way to fight that disinformation we just talked about. Give them the kernels of truth of what's going on routinely, repeatedly. It's almost like a persistent engagement strategy with our Marines. And yes, we'll be leaders and we'll do the kneecap to kneecap, but we can enable that with some technology now. So Kyle, I think that came from today. We got to get there where they are on the space, and they're already on their own devices. So let's embrace that.
So Rich is not here, but I can feel his knee shaking from many states away. And what I know he would say is, Brian, yes, 1,000 times yes. And we need to allow those Marines, while they're on their phone, to be able to signal to the Marine Corps where they're at, what they want to do, where they want to go, self-profess some skills, and have that be in a general repository of information that the Marine Corps can work through, so that as we work to both mature and skill up the force, we actually have information at our disposal, both what the Marines want and the direction they want to go, and then also our needs, and munge that together and give us the best Marines and the best Marine Corps that we can have. So here we go into our new segment, which is take questions from the listening audience. This one comes from 8th Com and not from Twitter. So the question is, and we're also going to open this up not just to the host, but since we have Brian on the cast and I know he has this question close to his heart, how should we consider DCO IDM, that is Defensive Cyberspace Operations, Internal Defensive Measures, companies in the pool of resources in relation to the rest of the cyber mission force? For instance, how do we deploy DCO IDM companies in worldwide assignable missions, potentially through Cybercom, if those missions do or do not align to MEF objectives? And I will caveat to that question so that for the listening audience, they can understand. The DCO IDM forces are forces that are apportioned to the Marine Expeditionary Force, not to Cybercom. Cybercom has their own DCO forces, and they protect the DODIN as a whole, as Commander U.S. Cybercom, who is dual-hatted as the director of the NSA, sees fit. So the Marine Corps said, hey, we will have DCO IDM forces that are able to serve at the whims of the MEF commander. So Brian, I'm going to kick this question over to you, and then Kyle and I will back clean up.
Continue to hate the name DCO IDM company. It's a cyber maneuver force, and it's employed under its capabilities and authorities to achieve mission objectives. And those are broad. Like you described, John, they are largely here in the Fleet Marine Force to help defend our weapon systems and platforms, understanding that organizations like Marfor Cyber do a pretty good job of defending the network writ large. But we're going to get down maybe just a layer deeper to help protect some of our technology here in the Fleet Marine Force. But, you know, for 2MEF and largely a UCOM focus, allies and partners are stand-in force. If they need a little bit of help, we'll probably go help them out, too, on their networks. I think about the level of kind of interchangeability of our networks, coalition networks. We need to be probably interchangeable. And so the broad answer to that question is, DCO IDM companies should be interchangeable with a cyber mission force, like a CPT. And really part of it is the Commandant is trying to make us a joint enabling force as well. I would see no issue with taking a DCO IDM company and pushing out forward to enable another element of the cyber mission force, or maybe even another joint force if that's what the mission required. So I think it's just a great cyber maneuver force to apply in a whole host of mission sets per the commander's priority is my gut reaction to that one, John.
Brian, you completely thunderstole me, because I was going to go in that direction. I was like, hey, I'm going to hot take this and I'm going to go. And you pretty much hit exactly what I was looking at. Yes, the force is for the MEF to employ, but I don't believe that means ... It must be on a network that MEF dollars paid for and that only 2MEF cares about, for instance. So, you know, plus one to what you said of, hey, who knows how we're going to fight? Maybe we will fight with a partner that can exist on our networks. Maybe we'll fight with a partner that we cannot share a network, and we have to figure out how to either use the internet or use some quasi-internet type thing And maybe the MEF commander's number one priority is securing that non-MEF network, maybe even not a, you know, quote unquote MEF mission, and maybe not a Marine Corps network. And I don't think that's necessarily bad. Or maybe the MEF commander has a skill set that he knows he wants them to accelerate or work on that's crazy, that's outside of the box, but he knows he wants to go there and can't get that experience in the Marine Corps. So he has something nutty that he puts them on, a difficult, wicked problem set, because that's what Marines do really well at. And maybe today that's not a MEF mission, but he knows in 2 or 3 or 10 years it's going to be, and they need to have seen that for the first time, not when lives are on the line. Kyle, what do you think?
So, John, as the civilian in this conversation right now, I'm feeling a little bit don't want to say the wrong thing, if you will. And I'm going to ask to phone a friend, my good friend Brian, to see if he could riff a little bit off of this.
Well, John, I'm sorry to steal some of your thunder. You know, I had a couple years to think about this. So I'll riff off of your conversation with Scott Cuomo, because I did spend a lot of time thinking about recon and counter recon from a cyber perspective. If we're trying to be an all domain force, when I say all domain, I do mean cyber and space, because the other three we've kind of done for a while. So the DCUIDM company is a recon and counter recon force. And we apply essentially a reverse targeting methodology. We put a red hat on and we look at our own networks and go, what are the most critical aspects of that network? And where do we think the bad guys are going to come to affect our network? And so we draw what we call in the military a named area of interest around that node. And the named area of interest is where we put a recon asset with, in the physical world, a pair of binos, and look for that adversary presence so we can react to it. That's all the DCUIDM companies are doing when they put their sensors on the network. It's an electronic set of binos. And when they see adversary action, they take action to counter it. So it's reconnaissance for cyber adversaries, and it's kicking them out when we find them. That's cyber recon, counter recon. And that's why I call it a cyber maneuver force. It's not just a defensive capability. You know, Marines, it's MCDP1, offensive mindset, bias for action, focus on the adversary. That's what we do.
Recon, counter recon in cyberspace is how you end an episode. Yeah. I have no comment. I have no additional things to say. The only correct thing to do right now is to take the baton and fling it over in Kyle's direction to hit us with the hottest of hot takes.
All right. So I'm going to pose a quick challenge here, right? The Marine in me is not stoked that the Army is the one launching the very first BYOD pilot, because Marines are supposed to be first to fight, and I want to be first to zero trust or first to BYOD in some way, shape, or form. So here's my hot take. This technology is new. It's going to be a challenge to adopt it, but I have seen Marines do far more complicated things in far less time, right? Our last episode talked about mounting like mobile radar stations on quads that you drive off the beach and deliver wireless data back to the entire fleet. Like, that is harder than this, I promise you all. So here's my challenge, right? Here's my hot take. First Marines that can launch a BYOD pilot, I'll fly to you. I'll bring my Chromebook and you can log in on my device to some system and we'll take a picture. We'll put it everywhere that we can put it on Twitter and LinkedIn, and we'll get to do some subtle humble bragging. Right. And by the way, all the drinks at the O Club and the E Club are on me whenever we do this. We're going to do this. I want to extend this challenge. So, Brian, it's time for the second MEF to get to work right now and get this thing going, because I would love to come back to Camp Lejeune and hang out with all my old buddies.
Challenge accepted, Kyle. I'll have a talk with the G6 tomorrow.
This is great. I just want to point out, this is the second time a gauntlet has been thrown. The first time was when Chris Drake came on and threw a gauntlet DCOIDM wise. So fitting that Kyle comes back with a gauntlet while a rep from 2MEF is on the line. I just want to remind you, Kyle, the internet is forever. So I hope you keep space on your credit card, good sir.
I'm ready. I'm ready, willing, and able to BYO drink us all to victory if you can.
Dear listeners, thank you for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter and following at @USMC_TFPHOENIX. That is @USMC_TaskForcePhoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Jake Osborne. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving us a 5-star review and accompanying comment. And with that, we are out.